For most of the 20th century, audiences were lured to the movies by beautifully designed and illustrated film posters and promotional imagery. Most of this commercial art was produced by talented illustrators and artists, a few of whose names and work have become known outside of academic and collector's circles. One of those artists is Bob Peak. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Bob Peak was a master of distilling a film's appeal into a singular image, and his work was central to the marketing of many great and lesser-known cinema titles. The life and work of Bob Peak fills a beautiful and hefty book by his son, Tom Peak, and I'm delighted to have Tom Peak on the program today. Good morning, sir.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us by phone from your home in California. I thought we should set the stage for this since we're talking about a largely visual medium. With these film posters and artwork of your father's that we could name a few titles, and I'm sure listeners will conjure up some of those images from your father's poster work. But he worked on West Side Story, Camelot, My Fair Lady, Rollerball, Apocalypse Now, Star Trek, The Black Stallion. The list goes on and on and on. A lot of these images are available as people listen. If they are near a computer, they can pull them up at bobpeak.com. I wanted to back up to your father's early career. He studied art at the Art Center in Los Angeles, and I guess like a lot of ambitious commercial illustrators and artists, he went to New York in the early 50s.
Yes, he did. Matter of fact, he was born in Denver, Colorado, and grew up in Wichita, Kansas. At a very early age, he had an interest in art, and he went to college after he got out of the service. He went to college for a couple of years over in Kansas, but in order to really develop his talent further, he felt he needed to go to a more, in a sense, prestigious art school. So he applied on a working scholarship for the Art Center College of Design in Los Angeles way back in the 1950 when it was on 3rd Street. And he had a working scholarship, and that's kind of where he honed his craft, after which he got out of school. He had met my mother there. They got married and so forth. They went to New York because that was really the center, New York or Chicago, of the advertising art scene. And what he did was he went to New York, and with very few dollars in their pocket, I mean, they really had a lot of gumption at that time. He felt he was a good artist. He felt that there was a place in the business for him. And early on, he started doing some very interesting work that a lot of people thought was a little bit too out there. They used to tell him, "Bob, your work is too flamboyant. It's too colorful. It's not going to sell. You got to have to pull in your reins," as they said. But he eventually landed this account for Old Hickory Bourbon Liquor in the 1953. And as my dad told me, I all of a sudden went from making nothing to $50,000 a year, and I was on the back of Book and Life magazine. And then after that, you know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Coke, Viceroy cigarettes, all of a sudden the job started flooding in. The reason for that is he had a style that he had developed that was kind of a removed style from what they were currently using, which was nice. But he was doing this really loose, heavy line, graphic design, very bold colors. He took liberties with his palette, and that's really how he got started. And, you know, the phone started ringing off the hook at his agent's office in New York.
Right place, right time. And I guess he caught something there, the germ of what would become what we think of late 50s, early 60s design. His work is, as you said, very colorful. And the colors are certainly not colors you would find necessarily in nature. They're oranges and pinks and deep blues, and they're just striking works of art. Was the initial reluctance of his first employers that, you know, people would be focusing on the art and not the product he was trying to
not
sell?
Not necessarily. He was working for an agency called, he had a chair, they call it, at Chite Studios. And he was just doing kind of what everybody else was doing, but he was very unhappy doing that. And my mother recognized that, and so she said, "Look, you know, you're unhappy." He goes, "Yeah, I am." He goes, "Well, why don't you do what you believe in?" And so he said, "I'm going to start doing what I believe in." And like he said, it was a kind of a phrase, "If it doesn't work out, I'll go back to California and work in a filling station."
There you go.
But he said, "I came into the art scene in New York at the right time when they were looking for fresh ideas, and they liked what they saw. And they liked my design work. They liked my bold colors." He always made a comment. He goes, "You know, back then there wasn't the computer age. It was all about print advertising." And he said, he used to tell me, "You know, once if you have an ad in a magazine, as soon as you turn the page, you're finished. They go on to the next ad or the next article. So what he did was he understood the idea of doing something bold enough that it would capture the viewer's attention, and they'd stop and look at that particular product or that story in like a Cosmopolitan magazine or a Red Book magazine, Good Housekeeping, whatever it might be. And that's really where his career started, and it started to take off very quickly in just a handful of years.
What's amazing, looking at the first quarter of your very thick, large coffee table book on your father's art, that first quarter is largely devoted to the 50s and his work in commercial magazines and such, and for clients like you mentioned. But despite being very modern, the work is also very impressionistic, and I know he studied the great painters and artists in art school. But what's fascinating to me is the way, and maybe this goes to your notion of having to capture the attention of someone flipping pages, but each painting, each picture is a scene that's staged, certainly, but it's full of story. The poses, the people that are caught in mid-action, sometimes with their backs to the viewer. There's a cinematic storytelling sense there at the very beginning of his career. So it just seems like he had all that he needed to move into the selling of movies at some point in posters.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when I do, I've done several presentations over the years on my father. I do them at universities, at some of the movie studios, several art universities. And what I do when I do my presentation is I show a series of his earlier pieces to explain to people, this is what caught the eye of Hollywood. The first film he ever worked on was West Side Story. They were, you know, they were seeing my dad's advertising work for magazines and product advertising and major campaigns, and someone somewhere down the line said, find out who that guy is. And they ended up calling his agent, and he called my dad and said, you know, there's this film they're doing on this play, this Broadway play, and it's called West Side Story. So what they ended up doing, they flew my dad out to California to meet the actors, the director, the studio execs, and that was really the first film that he worked on. He did a very big, beautiful montage piece that went along with the advertising, with the piece done by the great Saul Bass, who my dad knew very well.
Yeah, I think the two of them, Bob Peake and Saul Bass, if anybody knows the names of the great movie designers, it would be those two. And it's interesting that his first film would also be on a film that Saul Bass was working on.
Exactly. And then after that film was done, you know, he continued doing his advertising work, you know, doing quite well. And eventually he got another call from Hollywood. And this time he was doing, like, he did The Manchurian Candidate. He did some other movies as well. And it was nice work. He did The Train with Burt Lancaster. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden he did Equus, a while further down the road. But interesting enough, he gets another call and says, we've got another musical. And this one was another Broadway play, and this was originally with Julie Andrews, but we've got this gal named Audrey Hepburn, who's going to be in it with Rex Harrison. They flew him out again. He met everybody, okay? He met the actors. As a matter of fact, he always told me Audrey Hepburn was the nicest person he ever met in the film industry, was on the set, met the director, et cetera, and they wanted this to be, of course, I'm talking about My Fair Lady. Mm-hmm. They wanted it to be a Rex Harrison vehicle because he was kind of like big ego, and he was a big star. She had done a few movies in the past, such as Sabrina was one of them, and Roman Holiday with Gregory Peck. But what ended up happening was my father decided to use her as the centerpiece. And he came up with a series of idea sketches, brought those in, and they loved them.
It is called My Fair Lady.
My Fair Lady, yet they wanted Rex Harrison with her kind of over the shoulder. Uh-huh. In reality, he actually switched it. He made sure he put a hat on him so that his head is just as big or bigger. Because there's a lot of contractual things when it happened, you know, in the movie business. But what he did was he put her as the center figure, and that piece, which is really one of the biggest iconic posters, movie posters in the, you know, the annals of the movie business, that really started his movie career. It really took off after that with, you know, the Camelots and the Excaliburs and the Rollerballs and then eventually Superman. And then the pinnacle of his work was really the work he did for Apocalypse Now, which he always felt was his favorite, the movie work he was most proud of.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Apocalypse Now specifically because it is... of all of the amazing imagery he created, that one for me not only sums up his approach to design for movies, but is so beautifully rendered and so specific. I think it's a window into what made his work different, is that you could look at his posters, and not only are they displaying scenes from the film collaged in some way together, but if you know the film, they're also commenting on the film. And for viewers who don't know the Apocalypse Now poster, you have this large head of bald head of Marlon Brando with sweat coming down his head, becoming tears, which then fall and become this river that is bringing this patrol boat up the river, which, of course, is carrying the man who will eventually kill him. And it's all done in this dreamlike, surreal way that fits perfectly with the film. And I think your father had a way of distilling not only what you were going to see in a film so that you would want to go see the film, but once you knew the film, he was distilling what that film was about.
Yes, he did. Matter of fact, he always told me that his job is to try to encapsulate what the film is about in one picture, in one piece of artwork. And this is a great example. What he was able to do, my father, he was able to not just do that, but you can see the depth of the piece, the heart in the piece, and the passion that goes along with it. And he always taught a lot of other artists, students or artists that are working artists, that sometimes less is more. It's not what you put in, it's what you leave out. In those pieces, if you notice a lot of my dad's work, and Apocalypse Now is one of the major ones, obviously it's not the most major one, the main figure, there's the water down below with the dripping, and then on the top right-hand side, you've got Martin Sheen. And I've got a little story about that situation in a minute. But what he was able to do, if you notice, it fades out on both corners. It's all about the impact of the image. He doesn't need to necessarily fill in all the details of everything all around. He was really an expert at being able to understand when it's time to stop a piece, as opposed to continuing putting things in there. Now, initially, Robert Duvall was on the top left in the sky, just like Martin Sheen's on the top right. But Francis Ford Coppola and Robert Duvall didn't get along, and on the set, it finally came to a head, and they had a big blowout. So what happened was, Coppola is the one that told the studio and my father, I want Robert Duvall out of the painting. The original painting had Robert Duvall on the left with Sheen on the right up in the sky. So my dad actually had to take the painting back, and he had to take him out of there. So now you have the Brando with the boat and the water and the bridge down below, and then you have just Martin Sheen on the top right-hand side. Very few people realize that Robert Duvall was on the top left-hand side. That was really supposed to be the campaign, but it works beautifully anyway.
A lot of his posters are dense with information and meaning, and like the Apocalypse Now, they really use effectively negative space to an amazing degree, which goes all the way back to his early commercial career in New York in advertising. So that's, to me, one of the hallmarks of him, of his work. But do you have a favorite as you're putting the book together? You're wading through, obviously, a lot of iconic images. Do you have special attachment?
There's a lot of them. I mean, putting this book together was something else. It was interesting because I spent so much time researching, and even though I knew a lot about my father and his career, I even found works I had no idea he did. Some movie things, like he did some stuff with Sidney Poitier. He did advertising pieces, major campaigns. I had no idea he had done some of this work. For the Love of Ivy, that was one of the movie pieces he did with Sidney Poitier. He did, tons of stuff that I had no idea about. But it was really, you know, there was so much work, I could have done two volumes. And originally, I was going to just do a movie book. And I can maybe do that possibly down the road. I'm working on a sketchbook right now of all my dad's sketches. But initially, I was going to do a book on just movies, but I realized the first book out, I really need to show the breadth of his career so people understand where he started from and where he went with the movie and beyond, okay? Because he did, you know, 45 Time magazine covers, 45 TV guide covers, tons of work for editorial work for the Olympics in 1984. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Do I have favorite pieces? Yes, I do. They're not all movies. But if you were to ask me what are my favorite movie pieces, I would probably say Apocalypse Now, My Fair Lady, Camelot, Excalibur, and Superman. I think those are the five that I like the best. Superman is a great example. They didn't want to show anything. Richard Donner in the studio, they decided they didn't want to show anything other than romance and flight. So my dad did a series of pieces. You know, these, and this takes a while to, you know, you start with black and white sketches, you tighten them up, then you get to color comps. Then he'd finally bring in, you know, five or six finishes. And he did several finishes, and the finish that he did for the, that they ended up using was just this beautiful scene of these beautiful clouds with this street going by.
Right.
And the tagline was, "You'll believe a man can fly." And that's what they ended up using for the advertising. So, again, it was almost a teaser ad. So, again, it's almost the concept with my father, less is more. And when you look at work like Star Trek, you know, that iconic image he did of the beams coming down. He did the first five Star Treks. He doesn't put a real lot in, like Star Trek III is one of my favorites, Search for Spock. And I've met and spent some time talking with Leonard Nimoy, who was the main character in that piece. Matter of fact, he wrote something in my book for me, which was very nice of him to do. He wanted the viewer to take what they see and actually, in their own mind, where everything is not sitting out there in black and white for them, they can start thinking and wondering what's to come when I go in and see this movie.
Yeah, he preserved that sense of mystery and wonder. But he also knew when he was working with a property like Star Trek or like Superman, where the audience already has some preconceptions, and therefore he doesn't have to be as explicit in describing what that film is about. Looking over the breadth of his work, it's amazing that his mastery of so many techniques. Was there a preferred medium? Because he worked in just about all of them.
People ask me that quite a bit. And, you know, my dad was a chameleon. You know, he made a comment to me several times. He said, you know, he was self-employed with an agent for 40 years and did quite well in the business of being an illustrator. You know, made a lot of money. And he said, in order to be continually be in demand, I need to constantly evolve and, like, kind of try to stay a step ahead of things, come up with fresh ideas and fresh approaches. So he learned early on that, because a lot of artists, whether they're movie artists or whatever, they have like a certain look, and then what happens is they're hot for a few years, and then all of a sudden they're not really that popular anymore. So what he did was he was able to work with gouaches, oils, watercolors, pastels, mixed media, and it depended. If it was a Western piece like a Silverado, he would do kind of a Western thing, or Missouri Breaks with Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson. He did like a Western kind of feel. And then for something like Our Man Flint, Inline Flint, he did, or Modesty Blaze, he did this really neat kind of 60s type look. And then for something like Apocalypse Now, he would do something that was kind of dark and forbearing. So then also in his other work, whether it be, you know, the products or whether it be time covers, you know, he was, in a sense, quite the chameleon. And his draftsmanship, I mean, he mastered everything, which is really what blows me away, and people that I talk to constantly say, your dad could do everything. He could draw, he could paint, he could do watercolor, he could do the airbrush, he could do everything. Like, he really was an iconic, and as time goes on, he's becoming more and more iconic when you look at the legacy of his career.
You know, if you think about movie art and promotion, from almost the time of the invention of movies up until towards the end of your dad's career, someone was illustrating and designing and painting this poster art. And then, you know, by the late 80s, early 90s, we're moving to a largely photo-based art for our movie posters. And there's a sense that something has been lost. The posters of today don't have anywhere near the richness of meaning or attraction, at least to me, that your father's art has in spades.
True. You know, there's an old saying, as Confucius once said, change is the only constant. My wife and I, you know, we talk about movies a lot, and I'm a very big movie buff. As a matter of fact, I keep in touch with Frank Darabont, who's actually got some of my dad's originals, and I'm very good friends with Robert Osborne and Leonard Maltin. Leonard Maltin and Frank wrote things in the book for me, which was very nice of them to do. My wife likes animation, and she goes, you know, Tom, I really love, like, Snow White and Cinderella and all. But she goes, what they're doing now, it's so different, and it's so, I go, look, like my dad said, change is the only constant. Things constantly change. I don't think it's bad what they're doing now, but I do feel that the poster art that's being done now, most of it not illustrative at all, is somewhat of a cookie-cutter approach. Everything kind of looks the same. You've got the two big stars with their heads. They're looking good. You've got a little scene down below, and that's it. I'm not sure if they put as much effort into the print advertising, the one sheets, the key art, as it, I don't know if it was, if it's as important as it was years ago, because back when all they had was magazines, billboards, newspapers. It wasn't like today where all this computer stuff going on. And so people are using the medium of today, which is really the computer. So it's changed, yes. Also, remember, there are only a handful of artists that really have the ability to do that level of work. I think now a lot of illustrators, a lot of artists, they work on computers now. I mean, I do talks at universities, at art schools, and I see a majority of them, there's no printed, there's no paints, there's no brushes, there's none of that. It's just them working on the computer. So, you know, will it ever come back to that? I kind of think maybe occasionally, but I don't think that the era of Bob Peake, I think that era is gone now.
Your father unfortunately passed away in 1992. It's amazing to think about, after looking at this book, what he might be doing today with these new computer tools, given that he mastered so many medium. And I want to thank you again for talking with us. The book on your father and his art is certainly shows your love of him and the care with which you're preserving his legacy. It comes through in every detail. It's just a marvelous book. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about the book and your father.
And thank you very much for having me on the show.
I've been discussing the life and art of iconic commercial artist, illustrator, and movie poster designer extraordinaire Bob Peake with his son, Tom Peake. Tom Peake's impressive and richly detailed book on his father is simply called Bob Peake. And for more information on the life and career of one of the 20th century's greatest commercial artists and to order the book, visit bobpeake.com. The book is also available on Amazon. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.